Come now, all you mangy dogs. Swab the decks and hoist the sails. The guns on board be needing some proper manning. Pieces of eight and a fine wench on your arm, if your work be not too shoddy. Careful not to flounder too badly, though, or you may have to dance the hempen jig as we see you to Davy Jones. But Jeffy, my boy, on with the show.
Well, shiver me timbers. To our listeners from across all regions of the planet, welcome once again aboard the Robin Hood, flagship to the world's one and only cooperatively inspired charity podcast network. Broadcasting today from under widely sprayed South Korean skies, you've dropped in to a very hazily dimmed episode 57 of Pirate Radio Podcasts. I'm your host and ship's chief communications officer, Jaffe Ryder. Today's feature guest is New York Times best-selling author and award-winning investigative journalist, Mark Ebner. Specializing in celebrity and crime culture, his work has appeared in many other world-renowned publications, including Spy Magazine, Rolling Stone, Maxim, Premier, Spin, Radar, and Salon. His best-known work has ranged anywhere from going gonzo inside the cult of Scientology to covering pit bull fighting in South Central Los Angeles, the Ku Klux Klan in Texas, celebrity stalkers, seedy drug dealers, missing porn stars, sports groupies, college suicides, and hepatitis C in Hollywood. Ebner has produced for and or appeared as a journalist commentator on multiple top TV and radio networks. He's been a feature guest on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, Inside Edition, Tough Crowd with Colin Quinn, Fox and Friends, and a host of other world media outlets. In 2000, Ebner hosted his own nationally syndicated radio program and co-authored the best-selling Hollywood Interrupted in 2005 with The Drudge Report's Andrew Breitbart. Ebner also consulted on the Emmy-nominated Trapped in the Closet episode of South Park for Comedy Central and has most recently published the Hollywood crime thriller 6 Degrees of Paris Hilton. His latest breaking news blogs can be found on the corner of Sunset and Crime at HollywoodInterrupted.com. A little short-staffed here today, running things with a bit of a skeletal crew on the Robin Hood, but I'd imagine we'll be able to make do and get by just fine. Couple of our regular stringers that typically find themselves up in the crow's nest are down with what's either the chemtrail flu or some kind of strange pneumonia type symptom. So I'm not too sure about our guest either, actually. We're talking to him here just in the lead up to things. Mark, you're trying to keep it together pretty much there on your end too, I guess.
Well, I am, but you know, listen, don't worry about having a skeleton crew. I think that lean and mean can be just fine in situations like this. So have at it, Jaffe.
Yeah, I think we got a lot of great material and topics to dive into here. So, yeah, I think as I've let you know earlier, just in our private exchanges via Facebook, when I was younger, one of the careers and professions I had considered was exactly what you're doing, sort of sleuth, investigative journalist, kind of gonzo approach to, independent investigative news and journalism. So destiny has chosen a different course for me, however. You've been at it for quite a few years, and in the introduction, of course, we kind of laid things out there in pretty extensive detail.
We're going to talk about a few things today, including what you've written on topics, including the mysterious death of David Carradine, Scientology, and Hollywood's gay, or what some people refer to as Velvet Mafia. So, I guess as a starting point or a jumping off place here, one of the things that really kind of stands out, I don't want to really maybe spend a few minutes on, but you were the one who first broke the story on Bill Cosby back in 2006, and it didn't really seem to go over too well. It wasn't received with open arms exactly. In fact, it led to you being blackballed. Is that not the case?
Well, first of all, I don't know that I was the first. There was certainly, you know, a colleague of mine at Philadelphia Magazine was doing some good work. Some of the wire services were picking up on Cosby and his quote-unquote indiscretions. But for me, it was, you know, just journalism 101. You know, I got tipped off from a colleague of mine. He said, listen, you know, I know a woman who claims that Bill Cosby drugged and raped her. And I said, oh, really? Wow. You know, I said, can you introduce me? And he did. I talked to her on the phone, and then she came out from where she lives in New York State to she came out to L.A., sat down with and had lunch with her. She told me her story. And, you know, I believed her. I had no reason not to believe her. You know, I'm not the blame the victim type person, you know. And I listened to her story, and then I found another woman named Tamara Green, who was just about 50 miles north of me here. And I drove up and met her. And she essentially told me almost the exact same story in the exact same time period as this other woman, Joan Tarshis, from New York. And these two women did not know each other. This wasn't some plot against Cosby. This wasn't some extortion attempt. These were two women that after all these years and decades, if you will, were just trying to unburden themselves of this horrible, what happened to them. And it was amazing to hear their stories and to listen to them and then be able to look closer. You know, so I wrote the story. I put it up on my website, HollywoodInterrupted.com, and I tried to get traction for the story. In the media for decades myself, you know, you can imagine I have quite a few contacts in the business. So I put the story out there, and nobody would touch it. Oh, we don't want to libel Mr. Cosby. Oh, no, this is great. You know, and I was like, oh, my God. You know, so I threw it up on my website, got some traction there, but it wasn't until the Daily Beast decided to run a version of it that it went viral, if you will. And I'm glad it did.
And what year was this? The 2006, but how long did it actually take for the story that you put together to gain traction?
Well, till just about a year ago, I guess.
It took a year.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's been numerous women that have come forward since this time. You spoke to two in particular. Was that it? Or was there a couple more?
Two with very solid, similar stories. And then by proxy, you know, the woman, the athletic woman at his college back there, she was in the middle of a lawsuit and a gag order, but I got confirmation of her victimization, if you will, via her lawyer. So now I have two plus sources, two solid sources and one by proxy. And that was enough for me to go with it.
A gag order? How about that?
Well, you know, that's what they do when they make settlements. You know, they throw a gag order on the whole thing. And we're seeing this in all kinds of. It's really interesting to watch what's unfolding with Bill O'Reilly.
Yeah, right, $13 million, exactly. That's right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Just getting a quick update here from the YouTube live streaming chat area. The audio seems to be coming through, having a decent stream and signal there. Got a handful of people that have joined us, which is great to see people having a bit of an interest, of course, in hearing Mark and his story today. One of the questions that relates to this whole business of Cosby, we can maybe just spend another just quick few minutes here before we transition onto other talking points. The two ladies that you spoke to, were they both playmates, or one of them was? I'm pretty sure. Is that not the case?
No. One of them worked as a publicist. She wanted to do comedy. She was just, a woman with stars in her eyes who came out to Hollywood and tried to make her way. And, it seems like that Cosby experience really put a dampener on a lot of her dreams, you know. And the other woman became a lawyer. So these were just, women who were trying to move ahead and move forward in Hollywood, I guess.
There is, however, a Playboy Mansion connection and tie-in to all of this business, is there not?
Well, absolutely. There's, Bill Cosby was and Hefner were probably joined at the hip throughout the 70s and I would say into the 80s for sure. You know, and not a weekend went by where, Bill Cosby wasn't yucking it up at the Playboy Mansion. And, it leads me to, I think about, if I were looking into other aspects of this story, in that Bill Cosby has fully admitted under oath that he gave women Quaaludes to have sex. Well, Quaaludes are a hell of a drug, Jaffe. I don't know if you ever experienced methaqualine or methaqualine or whatever, however it's pronounced. But imagine you're best drunk and then times it by 10 and you kind of have an idea of the effect of Quaaludes. Now, the joke is, those are thigh openers. If you don't think you can get laid, slip her one of these. Well, no, I don't slip women anything. But back in the day, back in my drug days, if I had Quaaludes in any to share, sure, I'd want to do it with a woman because basically it was just like, I guess it was like just having a really fun, consensual romp in the hay, with a bottle of your favorite booze, magnified. Anyway, he admits to using Quaaludes to get sex. Well, let's face it, the man was dosing women, okay? No question about it. And Quaaludes, they call them thigh openers. They have all kinds of, jokes about it. But really, I mean, it's a heavy drug. And if you take more than one of those, it's a knockout drug for sure. And that seemed to be his MO, knock them out and violate them. Well, at the Playboy Mansion, you wonder who was the source of those Quaaludes. I mean, these were a heavily scheduled and regulated drug, even back in the 70s and 80s. How was he getting them? Well, you look into the Hefner scene, a name that will come up would be Dr. Mark Saginaw. That's S-A-G-I-N-O-R. Mm-hmm. And he was the Dr. Feelgood. He was essentially Hef's in-house Dr. Feelgood. He was always on hand. He practically lived at the mansion. Well, he's dead now, and dead men can't sue. So I would look to him as the most likely source of those drugs in the mansion. Certainly, Cosby, I have no doubts as to whether or not he was drugging women at the Playboy Mansion by the simple fact that there's an anecdote that I know you know. Let's not be coy here. There's a secondhand story that comes by way of a very fine actor by the name of James Caan.
Right.
And the only reason why I'm putting his name out there is because I reached out to him while I was researching my story to get him to confirm whether this was true or not. And through his people, he never responded. So I did my diligence, if you will. And the anecdote was, they'd be sitting there, the boys would be sitting there on movie night or whatever the occasion was. And all of a sudden, there's a playmate that's being yanked out of a room practically on a stretcher, a quote unquote comatose playmate. And, they'd be sitting there leaning back, chomping on their cigars saying, oh, yeah, they're coming out of Cosby's room. So that just goes to show that this guy had been doing that kind of stuff for a long time. And at the time, in the boys' club that was the Hefner Mansion, You know, this is the kind of thing that you wouldn't even flick a cigar ash off. You know, you just wouldn't. It was just another day in the Bacchanal. You know what I'm saying?
For sure. Cosby, too, let's not forget, he actually had, there was a bit that he did back in the day, same time period, as I recall, dealing with Spanish Fly. I don't know what Spanish Fly is exactly. I think it's something along these lines, kind of a panty remover, kind of like a date rape type of drug, maybe not that strong, or just something to kind of help to get her in the mood, I guess. Is maybe.
Oh, gosh. The Spanish Fly was, it was a mythical substance, and I remember as a kid, and this is going back to the 60s, you know, in the back of comic books, you would see X-ray specs.
That's right.
And they'd be pointing it, you know, in the cartoon to the marketing cartoon, you know, would be, if you put these on, you can see right through her clothes, you know. And, you know, it was just shameless marketing. Geez, I can, you know, see a woman naked and she wouldn't even know it. Did these things work? Were sea monkeys really real? You know, I don't think so. And they would always offer up, you know, send $5.95 with this coupon and we'll send you ersatz Spanish Fly. And I always thought that was funny because ersatz means fake.
Ah.
And yet the idea was this is the stuff that's going to get you laid. You know, I just guess it appealed to the prurient interests of people at the time. He wasn't wrong in that, you know, kids of his era and my era were fascinated by the idea that there was this substance out there. You know, our hormones are raging, you know. This would be the magic elixir, the fixer, the thing that would actually get us laid. But, you know, very few amongst us actually resorted to drugging and raping women and thought of that with any erotic sensibility, except for, I guess, Bill Cosby, America's dad, the Jell-O man.
Isn't that something right out in plain view, as so much of this tends to be. So Joe Eminon chiming in here, Pirate Joe in the live streaming YouTube chat area, something about disco biscuits. Maybe that's he's saying here. It's,
oh, good one. Joe's right on. Yeah. Disco mm-hmm. biscuits was another name for Quaaludes. They called them biscuit because the pill itself was about the size of, I'd say, somewhere between a nickel and a quarter in circumference. It was a big pill to swallow. You know, by the same token, if you're into heavy downers, that was the drug of choice for a few magic years. And apparently, in Cosby's case, felonious years, to put it mildly.
Right. He's added to this as well that he used to have a prescription for these. Half of them would knock him out for 5 hours. He had really bad insomnia, lots of pheromones-based aphrodisiac. You have to mix it with mold's blood. Okay. So another thing just to add as an addendum or just another interesting little sort of side fact is that there apparently does exist beneath the Playboy Mansion a series of secret tunnels and passageways. So that actually, speaking of James Caan, I think I might have read that one of those tunnels, believe it or not, is said to actually, I'm not sure if it's his house exactly. It might be. I'd have to go back and kind of dig that up again. But there's a number of quite prominent celebrities that either did or still do have real estate in that approximate location. Do you know much about these tunnels?
I don't. you know, the location you're talking about is not far from where OJ used to live.
How about that?
It's up in Holmby Hills. Of course, he wasn't actually there, but it wasn't far. I've been to the mansion once, and I can only tell you it was, I was there working as an entertainment journalist, and I was there for the run-up to, I believe, the Playboy Jazz Festival. You know, I wasn't going to miss an opportunity to visit the mansion. I certainly wasn't getting invited to any of their parties, Midsummer Night Dream and all that, and all those fantasy parties. But, you know, listen, I had grown up wearing Playboy magazine out,
Sure.
And, here's my opportunity. So I go on the junket, I get off the bus, I meet Hef, I take a photo with him. In fact, I'll send you that photo, when we're done here. And I went down to the grotto, the infamous grotto. Had I known about these tunnels, I would have been looking for them. But I didn't know about them, the caves or whatever. So I went down to the grotto. And, there were a few playmates walking around in various states of undress. It was, very pleasant to be there. But I went into one of the, speaking of caves, there's little nooks and crannies all around the pool and everything.
Right, yeah.
And I found a little dressing area, and there was a big plush white robe, bathrobe, clean, ready to be used, maybe quite possibly by Hef himself, should he get out of the pool and want to slide into his trademark robe. Well, I saw this robe, and I said, fuck it. I stripped down. I put the robe on. I walked out of this little nook or cranny, and I strolled around the pool with my nose in the air, just sort of emulating Hugh Hefner.
You're going gonzo, man. You're going gonzo on the Playboy mansion.
Well, yeah, I had to. I mean, wouldn't you?
Well, there you go. Exactly.
Yeah. So that's my experience. The other was, let's see, there was one woman. If you're at a computer, you can probably look up her name. I tried to forget it. She was known as the Lawyer Bunny. She lived in the mansion when he had his – she was one of the rotation of women he had living in the mansion with him at the time. And she wanted to write a book. And I said, okay, great. We're going to call it Bunny Tales. And you're the Lawyer Bunny. Now start talking. I'll write a proposal with you. Well, I wrote the book proposal. We sent it off to our, mutual agent at the time. And, I thought the project died in the water. Well, almost a year later, I see a book being promoted called Bunny Tales by her. And it's about to come out. Well, I called that agent and I said, you better send me a check. In fact, overnight FedEx, and it better have the right amount of zeros on it. And sure enough, he did. And I got paid off, and her book came out. I don't know how well it did. I hear she even thanked me in it. But thanks isn't enough. If you're going to sell my work product, I better be in on the revenue stream. That's all I can say.
Absolutely. We could go into that a little further, I suppose. How much time did you actually put into the project?
Oh, I don't know. I didn't write the book with her. I wrote the proposal, the vehicle that got it sold. I interviewed her a couple of times, one time at length for over 3 or 4 hours. I had a handle on it and just put the proposal on the page and, thought it just died in the marketplace, but it didn't.
Sure. We'll look into that more after things wrap up.
Oh, sure.
And add that to the show notes. So
yeah.
Now this is something that jumped out at me here and just doing the research and the lead up to our discussion here today is that you actually were friends with Andrew Breitbart. You, in fact, co-authored a book with him. I think you might have done a few projects with Andrew, but one of them was your well-known publication that you put out entitled Hollywood Interrupted. So that's the kind of, to me, I'm just, I don't know if I'm a little off base here or not, but a bit of a kind of an oddball sort of matchup there. The two of you aren't really, as far as on the same political page necessarily. How did you meet and how did you get to the point where you're actually working on this project?
Well, it's
together?
Kind of funny. Andrew and I met through the magic of AOL Instant Messenger. It was essentially, pretty much the tail end of the bright dawn of the internet. Drudge had his page up, and Andrew by that time had left a gig, writing for Arianna Huffington, and he, got the gig working the swing shift on the Drudge Report, and, essentially, Andrew showed him, Matt Drudge showed him, you know, the secret sauce, you know, gave him the recipe on how to, spin news links in, you know, to maximum effect. And he got good at it. And so we would chat on AOL Instant Messenger and trade story leads and things like that. And, we were just collegial and friendly. And he was, significantly younger than I am, and he passed far too soon, and he really was a good friend. But he said, hey, Mark, in Instant Message, he said, turn on the television. You know, I turn on the television, and there's, who was it? Anne Heche being interviewed by Barbara Walters. And it seemed like she was having a psychotic episode on, a national news show.
Right.
She was speaking in an alien space language. And we were just marveling that Barbara Walters wasn't like, honey, do you need to take your medication or just cut to something, but she let this mad woman rave on. And we were just like, my God, this is, Andrew kind of coined the term insanity chic, where this kind of behavior was not only, being embraced, it was being promoted by the media, and we were just marveling at that. And so it didn't really matter what our individual politics were. I mean, as far as, I was and still am concerned, I was this VW bus driving, Venice Beach dwelling, so far to the left, I'm falling into the Pacific, liberal, we were completely polar opposites,
right.
But the fact of the matter is we landed on the same page with our mutual loathing for celebrity. The trope for the book, our thesis argument was that celebrity is a disease, and the book will be us staging an intervention on it. And we just had a ball. The book started writing itself in Instant Messenger. We met. We hung out. I met his family. We had a ball, And this book, it's interesting. It was my second book that I had worked on. And, this one is the one that'll make your father proud. It became a New York Times bestseller. And, you can never take that away from me.
Yeah, we're definitely interested in being able to have listeners in our audience, people that visit the website, get a chance to easily access your books, including Hollywood Interrupted. 6 Degrees of Paris Hilton, I think, is another. And I don't know, how many books altogether have you put out now?
I believe I've worked on 6 books. Hollywood Interrupted, Being Uncle Charlie.
Poison Candy.
Poison Candy, We Have Your Husband, Ain't It Cool, what else? There was another book that I ghosted on. I'm not going to mention the title. I kind of bowed out on it when I realized I was in way over my head. It was a business ethics book. It was a money job I was working on. Yeah, there's a nice handful of books, all of which I'm quite proud of, all available on Amazon.com.
It's too bad. One of the things we didn't do in the lead up to the show today, we've had other authors that have, because of the control that they hold over their work, that they're able to offer special deals to, people, like listeners of the show that then contact the authors such as yourself with a, secret code word, pirate radio or something like that, and get a bit of it.
Well, listen. But, here's a standing deal I offer to anybody that that purchases one of my books, and that would be simply that if you buy that book, you ship it to me book rate. I will not only sign it, but I will personalize it for you and maybe tuck in some little surprise gift, and I will send it right back to you. There's that kind of thing. I make it a personal experience for the reader, and they seem to appreciate that. But other than that, I can't offer any discount.
Okay, there you go. That's excellent. So people are always cool with autographs for sure. Now, going back to Breitbart just quickly, and regarding his passing, a lot of people have speculated that it was quite odd, the circumstances and the timing. I guess he sort of just walked out of a bar and dropped dead on a sidewalk. Was that not kind of, I mean, there's more details to things than that, obviously, but do you have, I'm sure you must have a few thoughts on the matter. Anything that you're willing to share with us here today?
Yeah, well, I don't, I'm not going to buy into any conspiracies around his death. However, you know, people are welcome to think what they want. I had no prior knowledge that he had any heart problems. But I believe, you know, he had a lethal stroke right then and there. There's been no evidence presented to me that would explain it otherwise.
But you know that apparently in the lead up, just the day before, just something around, you know, just maybe even on that very day itself, he had made statements saying that he was sitting on some really big story regarding Obama and his history, and along the lines of like Dorothy Kilgallen with respect to the whole JFK thing, was going to essentially blow the roof off of the whole situation as far as Obama's history and past was concerned. That was one of the things you might have heard about. Secondly, there was a tweet that apparently it was his last tweet, in fact, that he sent out dealing with this whole Pizzagate business that everyone's heard about.
Some tweet from the grave, they call it, or something like that, where he straight up called John Podesta a pedophile. I've seen it. Maybe he knew something I didn't, you know, except that I didn't believe it for a minute. The whole Pizzagate thing didn't pass my smell test, no question about it. But people will always use that, you know, as their "see, I told you so" type thing. And, you know, if you think Podesta and Hillary Clinton and the gang were running a pedophile ring, you know, I'd have to say, you know, show me some proof. And it better not, you know, come by a clearly, for lack of a better word, unhinged tweet from my old pal, the late Andrew Breitbart. So I wasn't buying it. But yeah. I am aware of the theories.
And then WikiLeaks and all that sort of thing with the Podesta emails and whatnot. I don't want to get into that, though, to set that aside. Although the one thing I will add, just in closing, is that apparently his coroner dropped dead within just a few days of working on trying to get to the bottom of what actually killed Andrew. I think that's how the story goes. Have you heard that as well, that his coroner just suddenly died?
The coroners in L.A., they drop like flies. No, I don't know. I honestly, I stood up from my... I was the token liberal that got up there and spoke at his funeral.
Right.
You know, remembering him as a friend.
Sure.
And not stumping, you know, for the Tea Party. You know, I just, you know, that's how I remember him. He was just a good guy. He wanted to be a pundit. He succeeded beyond his wild expectations. And somewhere along the line, he went overboard. He went in too deep. And I started seeing the signs, you know, years ago, during the Occupy Wall Street, when he was running around the Occupy Zone yelling, "Stop raping people, behave yourself." I'm sure you've seen that classic on YouTube. Well, I called him up and I said, "Come on, Andrew, stop raping people." And he just started laughing.
Tone it down.
And, you know, I tapped out of our friendship at that point.
Okay, well, you know, shifting gears a little, and thank you for your frankness on the matter and insight.
Sure, you know, I mean...
That's why you're here, I guess, right? In the hot seat,
yeah.
So...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but, yeah.
Yeah, okay, Scientology. Louis Theroux recently came out with a new documentary. Have you had a chance to see it yet?
I did. I was at the Los Angeles premiere, invited by Louis.
Wow.
And actually I made off with one of the posters from that, and he'll be back in LA in August, and I'm definitely going to get him to sign it. But it's a great film. I love his take. I love his style. I love that he got one of the former top dogs in Scientology, Marty Rathbun, to actually be in it. And speaking of, you know, freaking out and cracking up, I don't want to give away too much of the film, but wow, you should see what happens to Marty. I hope people you know, find a way to see my Scientology movie, and it's not mine. It's all Louis, and it's really good.
I actually did manage to see it myself. I think I accessed it via Popcorn Time or something like that. So, but yeah, right. I've been a big fan of Louis for quite a while. In fact, recently pitched him an idea because he is looking for new documentary material. I'm not going to let the cat out of the bag right now, but
right.
What I will do, I'll tell you just off the record, well, for the record, but behind the scenes, I'll let you in on what that's all about and fill you in more on the details. You yourself might be interested in kind of following up on this lead, this potential scoop here. So we'll just leave it at that right now, you know, for the moment. But yeah, so, and Scientology, stalking you a little bit on, I think it was Twitter. Jenna Elfman recently had quite the ordeal via Reddit, I guess, and you were kind of, you thought that was quite something.
Well, I
what was the deal there?
I can't say I was the first one to report on it, but I was certainly out front of it, out in front with that. She, my wife's a big Redditor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she grew up on the internet, so she teaches me all the ins and outs. But my God, Jenna Elfman, you know, listeners will remember her from, what, Dharma and Greg,
yep.
I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, she has a new series, some sitcom on ABC. I don't think it got reviewed very well. I can't quite think of the name of it. But in an effort to promote that, some publicist had the bright idea of having her do one of those Ask Me Anything forums on Reddit.
Blew up in her face.
You're a known celebrity Scientologist. You go on Reddit. Redditors, you know, are very in tune, you know, with all things Scientology, as most internet dwellers are at this stage of the game. And you're welcome for all that. I'm glad my efforts paid off since 1996 when I first started investigating them for Spy Magazine. Mm-hmm. But how do you like that for a self-plug there?
Oh, I love it, man. That's why we got you, we brought you on board the Robin Hood here today. Oh, speaking of which, God damn it, we forgot the pirate story. We'll get into that after you finish up with Jenna Elfman. Please continue.
Okay. All right. Well, so Jenna Elfman, you know, it's this ill-advised idea. She gets on there, and apparently she invited, like, maybe a dozen sock puppet accounts.
Uh-huh.
You know, people, probably Scientologists, they opened accounts on Reddit less than an hour before showtime.
Friends of Xenu.
Yeah, and they were all asking, you know, her, how do you keep your skin so good? You look so beautiful. Oh, the show is so funny. Blah, 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 blah. And what happens on Reddit, mob rules. And the people there started immediately downvoting all the sock puppet. I'm losing my voice here. I apologize. Started downvoting all the sock puppet comments and started hammering her with Scientology questions until she disappeared, until she just logged off.
Wow.
And it's a living, breathing archive of hilarity and, you know, a real primer on the absurdity of Scientology. If you look at it, she's doing a forum on an internet forum that her cult would not even let her read. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
It was, I think Woody Harrelson did an awful one, but I think it's definitely in the top five of abominable Ask Me Anythings on Reddit. That's for sure.
Woody Harrelson? I didn't hear about that, but all right, we'll have to. That sounds like...
I may be confused, but I think it was Woody Harrelson, and you or one of your listeners can correct me, but his whole attitude was, I'm not going to answer any questions that don't have anything to do with the movie I'm on here to promote.
Hmm.
Well, the forum you're doing is called Ask Me Anything, right. Motherfucker. You know, so whatever. If it wasn't him, sorry, Woody.
So that was quite the ordeal, obviously. Scientology, you know, Louis Theroux, once again. There's been a few movies, I guess, and documentaries that have come out over the years.
Lawrence Wright's Going Clear.
Right.
His book and the movie based on.
You yourself, speaking of which, actually had a hand in helping to advise the fellows from South Park on the infamous Scientology episode, which I guess, based on some claims, is one of the most popular shows that Trey Parker, Matt Stone have put together to date. Is that not the case?
Yeah. I mean, what an honor. I mean, to be contacted by Matt Stone and Trey Parker. Up until then, I only knew them socially because they threw, bar none, the best Halloween party in Hollywood. And believe it or not, I'm not much of a party guy, you know, but that was one party that I would make every year until they stopped doing it. You know, so I only knew them like on the social circuit, if you will. And, you know, I mean, I love them. I love the show. And their producer reached out to me and said, would you come in and consult on, we're going to do it. We're actually going to do a Scientology episode. And I was like, well, when and where? Of course I'm there. And it was funny. They, you know, I'm sure anyone listening has seen it. The infamous Trapped in the Closet episode featuring R. Kelly, probably at that point, I guess that's almost a decade ago. It was just before South Park's 10th anniversary that episode went viral. When they were putting it together, you know, at Comedy Central, they had free rein to, you know, go mock anybody, Muslims, Jews, vegans, you know, you name it.
Careful but with the Muslims. Can't do it. Remember that whole dust up, but yeah.
Sure, continue. You know, but they were allowed to do Scientology, but here's where they got tripped up by standards and practices, as the legend goes. Apparently, Matt and Trey, when they were conceiving how they were going to do it, they said, hey, can we say Tom Cruise is gay? And the lawyers were like, absolutely not. They came back to him and said, well, can we put him in a closet that he can't get out of? And they were like, absolutely. And then it was like game on. And there you have it, Trapped in the Closet.
Yeah. But the thing, I guess, is he's not gay, apparently. Although I know, I think you kind of think
which
that
makes it even funnier.
Right.
You
yeah.
know?
John Travolta?
He's a guy who will sue your ass yeah. off if you're even thinking he's gay.
Right. Yeah.
Because apparently he can read your mind. Apparently, in Scientology, he has full power over matter, energy, space, and time. But like I said, if you're all that, Cruise, why couldn't you create a hit out of that awful movie Far and Away, which was the bomb he was coming off at the time when I wrote the Do You Want to Buy a Bridge for Spy Magazine?
Yeah, that got you into a lot of hot water, too, I guess. In fact, Rolling Stone, they dropped the project, did they not? They shelved it, and they paid you off, I guess?
No.
No?
The story was commissioned by Spy Magazine in 96, and it was basically me just wondering who all these weirdos, you know, stealing valor and being, you know, dressed in sailor suits running around Hollywood. I mean, what's up here? You know, so I just went in blind and I joined and wrote about my experience inside the cult.
Yeah, totally gonzo. You embedded yourself within the cult of Scientology.
Right, and what better way to find out what the cult is all about than immerse yourself? You know, that's how I like to do things, for sure. And that's what I did. And the story came out. Scientology was obviously aware that it was coming out. They threatened to sue. They put me in the magazine on notice. And my attitude was essentially, oh, really? You're going to sue me? For what? For recounting my experience? For quoting sources? For doing my fucking job? Bring it on. I said, you know, and I intoned. I made it very clear that in my hip pocket, not literally, but I had a subpoena for every celebrity Scientologist. You know, in order to successfully sue for libel, you've got to prove damages. And that would mean that for discovery, I would be able to open up their books and see if, as a result of my story in Spy Magazine, did the celebrity contributions to Scientology go down as a result? Did I damage them financially? And the answer was, they're not going to sue me because they never open the books. You know what I mean?
No, they never do, do they? That's everything is kept completely locked down, of course. All the, you say depositions or, that's not the right word, just where they basically, the confessionals.
They litigate you to death.
Absolutely.
If they can. You know, for me, it was putting private investigators on me, going through my trash.
Right, yeah.
Trespassing. Surprising me at the supermarket.
We've got pictures of him with members of the underworld. Come on, what kind of character are we dealing with here? You know, so that's what they tried to use on you, I guess.
Investigative
journalists, what do you expect?
And like I, you know, look, like I like to say, I saw them coming before they did. I met dozens of people who had finally blown the cult of Scientology.
Right.
They had gained enough clarity to be able to share their stories with me and tell me what to expect from Scientology. So I knew what they were going to do. In fact, if you read the very first paragraph in, you know, the spy story, Do You Want to Buy a Bridge? I open by fair gaming and dead agenting, to use their jargon for harassing people and, you know, trying to blackball them. I said, look, I'm an ex-junkie. I've solicited prostitutes in my day. I've masturbated and inhaled at the same time. I owe the IRS this much money. What else can I tell you about myself? Since you're going to put it out there anyway, I'll just put it out. And it was extremely effective because they've never been really able to discredit me in any way. I did it up front. You know, so it's like every time I go up against them, I win. You mentioned Rolling Stone. Well, years later, I sold a piece to them for their college issue on a brilliant young man named Philip Gale.
Who committed
suicide on L. Ron Hubbard's birthday, March 13th. I forget which year. I can look the story up. Anyway, he threw himself off the tallest building at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. I sold it on a verbal pitch to Rolling Stone. I was on a plane to Cambridge to Boston the next day, and I worked very hard on this story. Problem was, this kid was raised in Scientology, and it could be opined that part of what led to him committing suicide was given the virulent hatred for all things mental health, psychology, psychiatry, you know, you name it.
Medication, taking pills, pharmaceuticals.
The whole doctrine of Scientology is to destroy, you know, so that they can corner the market on the mental health field. You know, this kid clearly wasn't getting the help that he needed. You know, I'm sure that had to do with a lot of his cult programming growing up in Scientology. Well, long story short, Scientology became aware of the story, and they sent a packet, basically fair gaming me, to my editors at Rolling Stone, and I had warned them about this. I said, listen, this isn't a Scientology hit piece. I'm going in and I'm trying to recreate this brilliant kid's life, you know, through the interviews with his friends and people that knew him and loved him. And it's an amazing story. It was called Death of a Nethead. Anyway, I had filed the story. They sent this packet on me to try and discredit me. There were photos of me, you know, on the street talking to criminals, I guess. And I'm like, yeah, I write about crime. I'm bound to be photographed with a criminal or, you know, or an ex-con or something like that. Whatever. And they were like, Ebner, you need to respond to this. And I said, no. I said, I will absolutely not dignify them with a response. And I told you this from Jump Street. Yeah, they paid me. They didn't run the story. I walked it down the street to another outlet of mine, the late great New Times Weekly here in Los Angeles, part of a New Times syndicate throughout the country. I double dipped. They bought the story and they ran it. And I win again, you know. Years later, I talked to my assigning editor, Rolling Stone, and I said, what the hell happened there? And he said, well, You didn't hear it from me, but Jan Wenner, you know, and that would be the publisher,
sure,
editor-in-chief of Rolling Stone, is best friends with John Travolta. And I was like, oh, my God.
This is going to lead us into what we're going to hopefully, we have half hour left here to kind of cover the whole business of Carradine's death and Hollywood's Velvet Mafia. So I think we'll probably be coming back a little bit to people like Jan Wenner and Travolta a little bit, who, contrary to Cruise's apparent sexual orientation or leanings, Cruise being a straight guy, supposedly, Travolta, it's a little different story, I guess. So we'll leave that aside for now, though. That is their business, really. But speaking of the underworld, the seedy kind of types, you know, small-time crooks or, you know, bigger fish, what have you, I guess a lot of your work is quite popular via Maxim magazine. A lot of guys that find themselves locked up for, you know, however long it is that they're having to serve out their sentences, you get a lot of feedback from them, and they got a lot of fans there, I guess, that are find themselves behind bars.
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, Maxim magazine showed just the right amount of skin so that it was approved reading material in certainly state and federal prisons here in the States, and you know, so they get to read that, and they devour it. And they pass it around, you know. Playboy would be considered contraband in a prison. You know, in this day and age, they're looking at porn on the internet any chance they could get, because if you're a prisoner in a penitentiary without a cell phone or some sort of electronic device, you're shit out of luck, because everyone else has one. That's for sure. So, yeah, you know, my fan base, a lot of them are locked up.
You get a lot of correspondence coming in, letters and that sort of thing?
Sometimes, you know, when they get out of prison, when they get out of prison, a lot of them come to me and tell me, you know, oh, you know, the Wolf of Wall Street was a pussy. You should hear my story, you know, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, a lot of times they're just blowing a lot of hot air. And they're trying to cash in on what minor notoriety they may or may not have had. And sometimes they have really great stories to tell. In fact, 6 Degrees of Paris Hilton, that book, was divined from a guy who was doing a hard 10 at Corcoran State Prison up there alongside Charlie Manson and Sirhan Sirhan. I mean, this guy, I was corresponding him by the mail, visiting him. I got my PI license so I could get and have unrestricted taped interviews with him. So, yeah, you know, I got a lot of mileage out of writing for a magazine that's really popular in the penitentiaries. That's for sure.
The inmates, I guess, the convicts see it as being a lot, it's more acceptable, I guess, that otherwise they might be seen as snitches if they're, you know, talking out of school elsewhere. But in coming to you, there's a little bit more, maybe like street cred, or just it's seen as a kind of cooler kind of thing. I guess their stories are a little bit of part of what they're making claim to in publications like Maxim and whatnot. So, yeah.
Well, it's a good calling card. I'll give you an example. I was doing a story about, you remember the Bling Ring, that bunch of rich kids from out in one of the outer valleys of Los Angeles who were getting on Google Maps, and they were, it was a burglary ring. They were running around Hollywood, breaking into Paris Hilton and so-and-so and so-and-so and a bunch of other starlets who, you know, I'd just as soon forget. They were breaking into their homes and stealing stuff from them. Well, there was one guy that the cops couldn't round up. He went by the name Johnny Dangerous. He was the fence for all the stolen goods. If you're looking for somebody who's on the run, if you're looking for a fugitive and you're a crime journalist, here's my secret. And, you know, I share this freely. If you want to find them, you call their mom. That's all you got to do. Call moms. And moms know where they are, because for some reason, 90% of fugitives on the run, the first call they make is home, you know, where they feel comfortable. Through the mom, I got in contact with him. He knew my work in Maxim magazine because he had done a couple of years prior, and he told me exactly where he was, where I could find him. And I met him. I interviewed with him. I spent a couple of days in Vegas with him. I shadowed him all the way back to L.A. And I guess my calling card made him think and made him believe that he'd be kind of a rock star in when he went back to the joint, you know, for these crimes with as part of the bling ring. And he was going to turn himself in, and he did. And it didn't work out quite that well. I remember him calling me from county jail. He was like, "Hey, you said I was going to be a rock star. I just got my ass kicked." And I'm like, "Sorry, dude. You know, you did the crime, you know."
Jeez.
So sorry.
Yeah, people have to be willing to live with the consequences of their actions, of course.
Sure. So
whatever they may be. Hey, let's shift gears a little bit then, if we could. And, of course, there's so much that we could get into with your career. Has, assuming that it's as you said, several decades here, and you just have been pretty busy on all kinds of levels, of course, TV appearances, feature articles, and lots of, you had your own radio show back in 2000, of course, that we were talking about and referenced in the pre-interview. It would be great to access those archives at one point if you could get them up online. And,
sure.
You know, even if people had to pay a little bit, or like a Patreon or PayPal kind of deal. But David Carradine, yeah. You know, we really, because we time is the essence here. We got about a little more than 20 some odd minutes. Just in a nutshell, I guess, you made a trip to Bangkok.
I did.
Yeah. And if you could just fill us in, just to kind of break things down for us there over the next maybe 10 minutes or so.
Sure. You know,
yeah, what you found.
Listen, yeah, with David Carradine, it was, you know, they attributed his death to autoerotic asphyxiation, you know, that he strangled himself in a hotel room. So I flew to Bangkok. I made sure I was booked at the Nilert Park Hotel in Bangkok, the one he was staying at. I get to the hotel, and I walk down the hallway to look for his room number. And Buddhists, as you may or may not know, they're very superstitious. And they had disappeared his room. You know, famous guy dead in room, that room is no more. Mm-hmm. So they had just walled it off. So I found that strange. Then I went into my hotel room, and it was reported that photographic evidence showed him kind of lying on the floor halfway in his closet with a rope around his neck, which was like it was kind of a pulley system. Part of it was around his genitalia, and the other part was around his neck. And I guess if he moved his arms one way, he'd be pretty close to castrating himself. And if he pulled down on it, he'd choke himself out. Well, everybody's got their kinks, you know. Who am I to judge? If he wanted to go out that way, you know, I'm fine with it. He wouldn't be hurting anybody, you know, except for his loved ones who had to claim the body, I guess. But at the same time, something was fishy because they had said that he had strung that apparatus up, essentially hung himself in his closet. Well, David Carradine's well over 6 feet. Big man, okay? Kung Fu guy. A national hero in Thailand. I'm 5'6". I could barely fit as I was testing out the scene of the crime, as it were, in, you know, a similar room to his. I couldn't fit without ducking down in my own closet. The bar where you hang your clothes, even in a 5-star hotel, was cheap aluminum that I could snap with one hand. It never would have sustained his weight. Then, long story short, I get a knock on my door in my hotel, show you how secure it was. And there's a guy from the Bangkok Post, you know, an English tabloid in Bangkok, trying to sell me morgue photos. And I was like, well, I can't buy them from you, but let me have a look, right? And he showed me some thumbnails, and you could see the ligature, you know, the marks on his neck were such that literally what was tied around his neck almost took his fucking head off. You know, so I was convinced, absolutely convinced, that he had help with his demise. And so I made it my mission to try and find out who he got that help from. But at the same time, there were roadblocks put up everywhere. I asked to see the video, to see who came in and out of his hotel room that night. They wouldn't give it to the hotel manager. I sent him a bottle of scotch. He claimed he didn't have it. Went down to the cops, Bangkok police, through an interpreter, you know, basically he told me that he watched the video and that should be good enough for me. And he wouldn't show it to me.
Right.
And then I walked out and my interpreter whispered in my ear, he's lying, you know?
Yeah.
That crime scene was trampled over. It was a completely botched investigation. Then I got the head coroner in Bangkok to corroborate that. Because let's face it, in Bangkok, they do things differently. When someone dies, there's no like coroner van, official coroner van that rushes to the scene. It's, you know, they're essentially these people are body snatchers and they run around in flatbeds with CB radios. And they rush to the crime to be the one who, you know, like a tow truck driver in a major metropolitan area, being a gypsy and trying to get to the accident. You know, so they showed up. They took pictures. They, you know, because it's Kung Fu guy. There must have been about, I would imagine, thousands of dollars in per diem, you know, in his nightstand. So everything was dirty about that. And, you know, long story short, it's a great mystery, but I believe that he wasn't alone when he met his maker in that five-star hotel in Bangkok, Thailand.
You speculated, I'm not sure if you know you still maintain this position or not, but you think there was some sort of potential ladyboy involvement.
Well, I speculated. I mean, ladyboy, you know, listen, I can't say that, you know, definitively. I'm just trying to think of someone that would have the strength to do what I witnessed in the aftermath that was done to him. It was right. Pretty brutal.
He'd been doing this kind of kinky rope and pulley sort of that kind of gig, the fetish thing, for quite a few years, apparently, too. This was
I talked to one of his ex-wives, and she was like, yeah, people would come over and they'd say, where's David? And, you know, she'd be like, he's tied up in the basement again. You know, so she joked about that.
Was that Marina Anderson who wrote Eye of the Tornado was her book that came out a couple of years ago? She's someone that we've thought about getting her on the show, actually. So that's still, she'd be an interesting.
She's around.
Right.
Not hard to find.
Any way you look at it, really sad, of course. Now, whether it was an intentional, he'd come to the end of his rope, so to speak, and just made that. It's really quite strange, as you say, because the closet, they claim that they found his body there in the closet, and it's just, you know, he's the size of the man and his weight, and it just doesn't make much sense at all, and just the suspicion surrounding everything where any conspiracy.
Look, I mean, the bottom line, mm-hmm. Sorry, Jaffe.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry
go ahead.
To speak over you, but go ahead. Listen. The powers that be, and believe me, I talked to more than my share of powers in Bangkok. Someone should have come up with a videotape of who went in and out of that room, and there was a reason why they weren't showing that to me. I guess they would rather have a suicide on their hands than foul play to be broadcast all around the world. You know, I smelled the cover-up. What can I say?
Well, which kind of leads me to wonder who would have the motive. The thing that really comes to mind is because of his long time, and let's not forget, plausible deniability. Oh, he just kind of hung himself there, sort of Michael Hutchins, lead singer from INXS, similar kind of deal. And, yeah, so the plausible deniability of having killed himself this way, just all the big accident mistake, Robin Williams, maybe something kind of similar.
Let's put it this way, you know, I mean, I went down into the red light district in Bangkok, the cowboy, soy cowboy, went around there, I found a prostitute, and I was like, come on, how much would it cost me to have you come back to my hotel, and I want you to tie a rope, and I'm gesturing, and she understands a little bit of English, and blah, 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 just come choke me out. She said 500 baht. Maybe that's about $100. I could be wrong. I'm sure some of your listeners will correct me. But it isn't that great amount of money. So it would have been easy, you know, lady boy, female prostitute, whatever. It would have been easy enough for him to make a call and have someone come help him out with whatever role-playing situation he wanted to get in there with. Now, let's face it, autoerotic asphyxiation, from what I know about it, it's dangerous. Obviously. People have died from that. And, you know, families have to deal with so much on their plate around deaths like that. Yet at the same time, what would be the motive? Well, if someone showed up at his hotel door and realized that this is Kung Fu Guy and realized that there's a Rolex watch right by the bed, there's cash in here, what would, you know, there's opportunity there for the, you know, the wrong type of person. And they may have just had an eye on a bigger prize. And once that person had the rope around Carradine's neck, it would be like, screw this motherfucker, and just boom, choked him right out, almost choked his head off. It literally was right down to, you could see right into his neck. It was gore. The actual morgue photos that I got to eyeball, yeah.
Another possibility, and this kind of leads into, we had an earlier guest, William Ramsey, who is a researcher, author of occult topics dealing with Aleister Crowley, the West Memphis Three. I'm sure you've heard of probably both, I'd imagine, and maybe even William Ramsey. But he's got a question here that's going to kind of tie into things a little bit. But because of Carradine, the family, it's a very well-known Hollywood family, of course, with many relatives in the acting business and so forth. And him in particular with the martial arts history and the kung fu role. I guess it was Kane was the character name. Bruce Lee, I guess, had been initially, there was a lot of buzz and talk about him actually having the role. Carradine somehow managed to end up playing the part of Kane in the kung fu series. With respect to this, all the talk regarding secret societies, Asian, you know, triads and so forth, Carradine might have been a marked man for quite some time, and this is just simply where the powers that be, you know, in the underworld, and maybe there's a score to settle or something. He'd crossed someone, like I said, he'd been on someone's radar for a while, and that was just an opportune moment, and they took him out.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I don't know. You know, there's, you know, the whole business, the movie business in Bangkok, I imagine, is pretty sketchy.
Yeah.
You know, his brother John called me up, you know, after all was said and done, and he said, Mark, what happened to my brother? And I said, you know, I basically reiterated what I've just said about the whole situation. You know, I asked him, I said, listen, do you want me to send you the morgue photos? And he was like, please do. And I did. And I never heard from him again. And I don't blame him. By the way, if you ever want to see a movie that would seem to, you know, the average fan that's totally out of character, but I assume is completely in character, there was a 1989 movie, I believe, called Sonny Boy. And David Carradine plays the whole movie in drag as the mother to this feral kid. And I would recommend that you look at that. He was right at home in that role, more so than anything else I'd ever seen him in, that's for sure.
How about that? We'll definitely have to look into that then, I guess, obviously. So William Ramsey, though, going back to, once again, this is the guest we had on board. I'm not sure if you've heard of him or not. He's actually based out of Los Angeles himself. But what he wanted to know, he wanted to ask a question about Carradine's father and the Hollywood Hellfire Club. You ever heard anything about that?
Jesus, I knew nothing about that. That's deep. Tell Ramsey I'd like to break bread with him sometime.
There you go.
If he's talking about the Hellfire Club. I thought Hellfire was in New York. I guess they had a branch in L.A. I don't know. That was probably one of the most notorious and one of the most early, as in exposed, you know, people knew about it, gay fetish clubs where anything went. Where, you know, the idea of going in and getting fisted was like taking a walk in the park. That place allegedly, you know, from what I heard, was really dark and depraved. So, yeah, I didn't know that his father was up in Hellfire, but it doesn't surprise me.
How about
nothing
that?
Nothing surprises me about Hollywood.
So we'll put you in touch with or Holly Weird, as some prefer to call it. So we're going to try to see if we can bring Lord Stompy into the call here. We typically have someone up in the crow's nest, kind of holding down the co-host end of things, but he's off in Adelaide, Australia, so just got in from a street busking gig. Not sure if he's going to be able to make it up there or not with the time. We've got allotted here. Stompy, did you manage to make it up into the crow's nest? Maybe. I think he might be there.
I'm struggling, Captain, but I'm trying to make it up there.
Awesome.
I don't even know which direction we're headed today, Captain.
You might just have to just... I shot you a copy of the show notes there, and we got the live streaming link, of course, with Mark Ebner here, feature writer, investigative journalist, and prototypical Hollywood muckraker.
Hey, Stompy. Can I just say that pirates... incidentally, have been on my mind a lot leading up to this show. You mind if I just kind of run through my pirate thoughts?
The floor is all yours, man. We'd love to hear. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, I'm friends with Lee Ehrenberg of the Pirates of the Caribbean endless series of Johnny Depp movies. He's the one that goes, "I pop it, little guy."
Okay.
Stocky, bald-headed guy.
I pop it.
Yeah, I'd like the world to know that I let him beat me in arm wrestling. The other one is I'm sure you guys know of her and could tell me more about her than I do, but Madam Ching.
Yeah, she was like one of the most notorious pirates ever.
What a story. What a backstory. She was raised as a teenage prostitute. Working out of some brothel in 18th century Qing Dynasty China, she's probably raped and abused and blah, 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 and she ended up commanding like 300 ships at some point. And under her watch as pirates, you weren't allowed to rape. Pillage, yes, but if you rape, she'd cut your fucking balls off. So I'm really into her. And I was also thinking... Jaffe, you're in South Korea. How far are you from the DMZ right now?
I live in the central region of the peninsula, so a few hours south of Seoul.
Okay, because, to personalize pirating, my wife and I kind of realized that we were, if things, go off as a result of Donald Trump's, provocations with North Korea... our get-out plan is to head down to Marina Del Rey and, jack a boat with sail and some power. And I mean jack at gunpoint if we have to, because...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because, the person that we're jacking it from, it's like, you either come with us or you take a bullet, turn around in the back of the head. Which do you want? As the fallout approaches, I'd be doing a favor if... I double-tapped you in the back of the head. So, I was thinking I might have to end up... You guys might be onto something there. Those of us who want to survive what's happening right now, we might all need to become pirates. What do you think?
Well, that's why we're here. Like, we're ahead of the curve. I think we have a jump on most people as far as preparation, contingency plans, and that sort of thing goes. So, but here's the thing. I'll tell you right now, I've been following the news, as best I can. The latest developments and announcements is that actually China, and don't forget, Trump, he nailed that relatively empty airfield, I guess, in Syria there, just the day before, or on the day of the Chinese president coming to visit. What he did then, I guess, during their discussions, meeting with, was it President Xi? Or I'm not sure how you pronounce his name exactly. But the deal is now, apparently, China, supposedly, at least what's being, we're hearing through the mainstream outlets, is that China is now going to work on pressuring the DPRK, North Korea, to denuclearize. That's the position they're taking, supposedly. So, and that's from a high-ranking general. Well, I don't remember his name exactly, but those are the latest reports. So might not be time quite yet to go running around and trying to.
So you're saying you don't think El President Presidente's going to pop off a nuclear warhead for shits and giggles?
Oh, well, you're telling me? Yeah, I don't know, man. Who knows what goes on inside that man's head? I have no idea, of course. So, but that's what's being reported. That's what's being reported.
Well, you know, I mean, I put it out there. I'm available, you know, to go report at ground zero, if you will. There haven't been any takers yet.
We have a guest house here, Mark, so it's like our door is always wide open for, you know, friends, families, you know, people that come join us on the show. Not a problem. But here's the thing. Check this out. We got more stuff to talk about for sure because we don't have time to really hit on and dive into this whole business of Hollywood's gay mafia. But maybe in the after show, the Rogues Gallery, if you stick around for a few minutes. But
You know, that's okay because truth be told, the gay mafia in Hollywood doesn't exist anymore. When I was writing about it, the way it transpired, I kind of wish I didn't, just because it didn't come across the way I had originally planned. The point is, mafias don't have to exist. The gay mafia that everyone talked about, the so-called Velvet Mafia, the power brokers, you know, that were big in, you know, Hollywood in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, ultimately it's a whole bunch of so what, you know? Because they're all out of the closet now.
Right. They still hold a lot of power as far as, you might have heard of Milo on the Joe Rogan show recently where he talked about these Twinkie parties in Hollywood. I'm not sure what a Twinkie is exactly. It's some kind of, I guess, a nice-looking young man.
Yeah, I guess a twink is, you know, someone who's shaved in all the right places and passes as someone a lot younger than they are, you know. I think that's what twink is. Those parties, I'm sure they exist. If the twinks are of age, you know, I'm like, have at it, guys, have fun. If they're not, that's a different and much darker story.
Right.
And I know Milo liked to jawbone about that. I heard he mentioned Bryan Singer one time, this, that, or the other thing, but you know, for a guy who, you know, wound up coming out ostensibly advocating pedophilia, he's kind of become an afterthought. And who cares about Milo anymore? I certainly don't, right?
Okay. I try to stay pretty neutral on a lot of these things, really, just listen to what people say. And I try, you know, why take sides, frankly? But one of the things I will say is that in one of your interviews, I think I did hear you mention that you had attended one or two of Singer's parties.
Yeah, and, you know, and I'll be honest, I wasn't checking IDs at the door, but maybe someone should have been. And yet, there's no law against having, you see, it's one of those things, you know, these young guys are he liked them looking young. This side or the other thing. If I was there to report on it, you'll be damn well sure I would have looked a lot deeper than I did. But in retrospect, yeah, you know, those parties did happen. But that's as far as I knew. And my attitude was like, if I could convey anything to them, you know, would be, man, I hope to God you're not doing anything, you know, with underage boys. A lot of people have leveled those accusations. Can I say he was doing that? No, I can't say it. And because I can't and won't say it, you know, people get all like, oh, Ebner, you're trying to protect your friend. And I'm like, no, I'm not. If I knew he did, I would tell you as much. But I don't know that.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, sorry I have no blockbuster, you know, Bryan Singer stuff for you, but you know, that's just pretty much the way it is.
Yeah, and that's all we're looking for and all we expect from anyone that we ever have on the show is just their take and opinion, and we're never going to tell them, you know, how they think or what they should think. Or
yeah, and you know, I say leave it to the commentariat. Every time I've touched on this in the media, if you look at the comments on YouTube and whatever, you know, they say Ebner's a fucking asshole, he's protecting Bryan Singer, blah, 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 blah. I happen to know this. I happen to know that. Well, what's your name and will you go on record? No, they won't. It's the internet. Mm-hmm. But, you know, certainly people have their opinions about it and very strong opinions.
Sure. Now, you've kind of nixed the whole Pizzagate, that whole business. But, I mean, hopefully you're able to at least acknowledge that there are, that this sort of thing does occur on a wider basis, on a more kind of institutional level with, you know, political blackmail. And I would imagine, yeah, Hollywood would be one of those places. And sure, you haven't yourself seen any of this kind of thing firsthand, but it happens. It goes on. There's a lot of reports and stories where, you know, kids are traumatized and running around, you know, naked or ending up in mental hospitals or dead, you know, or what have you. So,
as to whether Hollywood's gay velvet mafia is actually in existence anymore or not,
I guess that's, well, if anyone wants to look into it, I mean, have at it, I suppose, would be the thing. But quickly, just going back, just one thing regarding North Korea, do you know that weed is legal in the DPRK?
Is it?
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Dude, man. And here's the thing. We called out Seth Rogen. We launched a Twitter war with the guy, and we took him down a single shot. You know, it was like, yeah, we won. You know, call out Twitter. And, yeah, so, but the thing is, here's the deal. Why pick on Seth Rogen? Because you remember he did that movie called The Interview. Now, Hollywood's biggest pothead goes to North Korea in the film to assassinate the dear leader. This one scene, I guess, he was being interrogated by these secret police or military police, what have you. He's smoking cigarettes. If I was writing the script, he'd be sent to North Korea to, like, you know, roll up a fat bomber or two to share with, you know, Kim Jong-un and just kind of kick back and relax, sort of maybe Dennis Rodman style. You know,
sure.
Or not quite that extreme, but right. here's the thing. So what we did is we're challenging Seth to put together a documentary because we want to work on getting to the bottom of things and more clear on where things stand as far as the legal status of weed. It is a blue country on Wikipedia, so which means it's completely fine. Here in the South, unfortunately, the fascist South, we're drowning literally in a sea of alcohol and pharmaceuticals. It's pretty bad.
Right.
You don't have that. Since 1976, I'm not sure if it was Ford or you wouldn't think it'd be Carter because, you know, because of his position, but who knows what was going on really behind the scenes. But yeah, the president at the time, Park Geun-hye was the lady, the daughter of the former dictator who just got taken out and she was impeached and whatnot. But her father was the guy who made it cut a deal with the states to bring in prohibition. And it's just been endless propaganda ever since then. But isn't that ironic? You know, the despotic, tyrannical North, it's completely legal. And a lot of, I guess, the soldiers and farm workers, after a hard day's work, they come home and kick back and just kind of wind down with a little bit of their weed, I guess. It's a traditional Chinese medicinal plant. So what's the big
deal? Well, you know, I don't know if I want to tip my hat to North Korea, but I will say, as a fellow proponent of the medical cannabis, at least they have that. I don't know what else they have.
Right.
They've got lots of cheap alcohol. My father went on a short visit. He said that alcohol's really abundant and super cheap there. So
they're short on cash. There's no reason they couldn't Pyongyang could not be transformed into the Amsterdam of Asia virtually overnight. You know, they got the vision, the will, and the means. The vision is there, and the means are there. They just lack the political will. So there's something funny going on where they could really develop and promote a pot tourist industry, you know, and just for some reason turning a blind eye and then putting a hand out asking for cash from foreign investors or people that are willing to donate. So, hey, listen, Mark, you've been really great, and we don't want to tie you over too long here. Just a couple of your website, your URLs and contact information, HollywoodInterrupted.com, I guess, is your main website. Right. Anything else you'd like to just let us in on as far as upcoming projects or work you're currently busy with and would like, you know, our listeners to know more about?
Well, I may be doing a surprise. I don't want to tease this because I haven't been authorized, but I'll be back, let's put it this way, in the next few weeks, big time, big exposure on the topic of Scientology. So that'll be fun. I can't really name the network of the show, but I'll, you know, you can guess. That's fine. What else? You know, I'm cooking up some crime shows. Writing books just isn't putting food on the table the way it used to, so I'll be promoting some a few shows that I'm working on now, those docu-series, and working on that. And, you know, I'm honored if anyone wants to take a look at my work, all archived at www.hollywoodinterrupted.com. It's been a blast, Jaffe and Stompy. That's it. I had a ball.
Excellent.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you very much. We have the Rogues Gallery coming up, you know, following things here. I'm not sure if you're going to be able to stick around or not. That's totally fine. Play things by ear. Stompy, I imagine you'll be able to join us for a little while, and a few others from the live streaming YouTube chat area.
That about does it for another week of Pirate Radio Podcasts, episode 57 with Hollywood muckraker Mark Ebner. Don't forget, if you're looking for a little more free-flowing action, we've likely got another great Rogues Gallery after show coming up next in Skype. Also, if you've been a regular listener, enjoying the weekly feature content we've been producing for well over the past year, you might want to drop by our new Patreon tip jar page and lend a little support. For the same price as a cup of coffee, you can help keep the Robin Hood sailing smoothly along each month. All it takes is a buck a week for anyone to win access to our regular behind-the-scenes premium Rogues Gallery content. Coming up next Friday night, an historic revisitation from Minds.com's co-founders, Bill and John Ottman, with renowned Canadian ufologist Grant Cameron rounding off April's quality jam-packed schedule. If you yourself have an intriguing idea for a guest or story, you can either drop us a line directly over on WPRPN.com, or fire us a quick email via PirateOneRadio@gmail.com. WPRPN network domain links are now also available. Great for artists, musicians, podcasters, bloggers, or pretty much just anyone looking to boost their online visibility and reach. Basic accounts can be launched for only $12 a year. Staking your claim now helps not only strengthen you and the network, we're also looking out for the little guy. That's right, folks. Half of all WPRPN's profits are redistributed directly back into supporting various charitable causes. After all, we are the Robin Hood. You can further embark on your own pirate journey by liking, subscribing, commenting on, sharing, and following any of our main social media channels via Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Google Plus, or Minds.com. So don't forget to become engaged. Until we meet again out on the high digital seas, I'm your host as always, the ship's chief communications officer, Jaffe Ryder.
Tally-ho!